Rag rugs on the shining floor were all in their accustomed places, just as if nothing had happened. It was a friendly and comfortable room, and ordinarily Scarlett loved the quiet hours which the family spent there after supper. But tonight she hated the sight of it, and if she had not feared her father's loudly bawled questions, she would have slipped away, down the dark hall to Ellen's little office, and cried out her sorrow on the old sofa. That was the room that Scarlett liked best in all the house. There, Ellen sat before her tall secretary each morning, keeping the accounts of the plantation and listening to the reports of Jonas Wilkerson, the overseer. There also the family idled while Ellen's quill scratched across her ledgers. Gerald in the old rocker, the girls on the sagging cushions of the sofa that was too battered and worn for the front of the house. Scarlett longed to be there now, alone with Ellen, so she could put her head in her mother's lap and cry in peace. Wouldn't mother ever come home? Then wheels ground sharply on the graveled driveway, and the soft murmur of Ellen's voice dismissing the coachman floated into the room. The whole group looked up eagerly as she entered rapidly, her hoops swaying, her face tired and sad. There entered with her the faint fragrance of lemon verbena sachet, which seemed always to creep from the folds of her dresses, a fragrance that was always linked in Scarlett's mind with her mother. Mammy followed at a few paces, the leather bag in her hand, her underlip pushed out and her brow lowering. Mammy muttered darkly to herself as she waddled, taking care that her remarks were pitched too low to be understood, but loud enough to register her unqualified disapproval. "I am sorry I am so late," said Ellen, slipping her plaid shawl from drooping shoulders and handing it to Scarlett, whose cheek she patted in passing. Gerald's face had brightened, as if by magic, at her entrance.
"Is the brat baptized?" he questioned.
"Yes, and dead, poor thing," said Ellen. "I feared Emmy would die, too, but I think she will live." The girls' faces turned to her, startled and questioning, and Gerald wagged his head philosophically.
"Well, 'tis better so that the brat is dead, no doubt. Poor fatherless.
It is late. We had better have prayers now," interrupted Ellen so smoothly that, if Scarlett had not known her mother well, the interruption would have passed unnoticed. It would be interesting to know who was the father of Emmy Slattery's baby, but Scarlett knew she would never learn the truth of the matter if she waited to hear it from her mother. Scarlett suspected Jonas Wilkerson, for she had frequently seen him walking down the road with Emmy at nightfall. Jonas was a Yankee and a bachelor, and the fact that he was an overseer forever barred him from any contact with a county social life. There was no family of any standing into which he could marry, no people with whom he could associate except the Slatteries and riffraff like them. As he was several cuts above the Slatteries in education, it was only natural that he should not want to marry Emmy, no matter how often he might walk with her in the twilight. Scarlett sighed, for her curiosity was sharp. Things were always happening under her mother's eyes, which she noticed no more than if they had not happened at all. Ellen ignored all things contrary to her ideas of propriety, and tried to teach Scarlett to do the same, but with poor success. Ellen had stepped to the mantel to take her rosary beads from the small inlaid casket, in which they always reposed when Mammy spoke up with firmness.
"Miss Ellen, you go and eat some supper before you does any praying."
"Thank you, Mammy, but I am not hungry."
"I go and fix your supper myself, and you eats it," said Mammy, her brow furrowed with indignation as she started down the hall for the kitchen. "Polk," she called, "tell Cookie stir up the fire. Miss Ellen home."
As the board shuddered under her weight, the soliloquy she had been muttering in the front hall grew louder and louder, coming clearly to the ears of the family in the dining room.
I have said time and again it don't do no good doing nothing for white trash. They is the shiftless, most ungrateful parcel of no counts living. And Miss Ellen got no business wearing herself out waiting on folks that, did they be worth shooting, they had niggers to wait on them. And I has said...
Her voice trailed off as she went down the long open passageway, covered only by a roof that led into the kitchen. Mammy had her own method of letting her owners know exactly where she stood on all matters. She knew it was beneath the dignity of quality white folks to pay the slightest attention to what a darkie said when she was just grumbling to herself. She knew that to uphold this dignity, they must ignore what she said, even if she stood in the next room and almost shouted. It protected her from reproof, and it left no doubt in anyone's mind as to her exact views on any subject. Pork entered the room, bearing a plate, silver, and a napkin. He was followed closely by Jack, a black little boy of 10, hastily buttoning a white linen jacket with one hand and bearing in the other a fly swisher made of thin strips of newspaper, tied to a reed longer than he was. Ellen had a beautiful peacock feather fly brusher, but it was used only on very special occasions and then only after domestic struggle, due to the obstinate conviction of Pork, Cookie, and Mammy, that peacock feathers were bad luck. Ellen sat down in the chair which Gerald pulled out for her, and four voices attacked her.
"Mother, the lace is loose on my new ball dress, and I want to wear it tomorrow night at 12 Oaks. Won't you please fix it? Mother, Scarlett's new dress is prettier than mine, and I look like frightened pink. Why can't she wear my pink and let me wear her green? She looks all right in pink. Mother, can I stay up for the ball tomorrow night? I'm 13 now.
Mrs. O'Hara, would you believe it? Hush, you girls, before I take me crop to you. Cade Calvert was in Atlanta this morning, and he says, "Will you be quiet and let me be hearing me own voice?" And he says... It's all upset they are there and talking nothing but war, militia drilling, troops forming. And he says the news from Charleston is that they will be putting up with no more Yankee insults.
Ellen's tired mouth smiled into the tumult as she addressed herself first to her husband, as a wife should. If the nice people of Charleston feel that way, I'm sure we will all feel the same way soon, she said. For she had a deeply rooted belief that, excepting only Savannah, most of the gentle blood of the whole continent could be found in that small seaport city, a belief shared largely by Charlestonians. "No, Corrine, next year, dear. Then you can stay up for balls and wear grown-up dresses. And what a good time my little pink cheeks will have. Don't pout, dear. You can go to the barbecue, remember that, and stay up through supper, but no balls till you are 14. Give me your gown, Scarlet. I will whip the lace for you after prayers. So, Ellen, I do not like your tone, dear. Your pink gown is lovely and suitable to your complexion, as Scarlet's is to hers. But you may wear my garnet necklace tomorrow night." Sue Ellen, behind her mother's back, wrinkled her nose triumphantly at Scarlet, who had been planning to beg the necklace for herself. Scarlet put out her tongue at her. Sue Ellen was an annoying sister with her whining and selfishness, and had it not been for Ellen's restraining hand, Scarlet would frequently have boxed her ears. "Now, Mr. O'Hara, tell me more about what Mr. Calvert said about Charleston," said Ellen. Scarlet knew her mother cared nothing at all about war and politics, and thought them masculine matters about which no lady could intelligently concern herself. But it gave Gerald pleasure to air his views, and Ellen was unfailingly thoughtful of her husband's pleasure. While Gerald launched forth on his news, Mammy set the plates before her mistress, golden-topped biscuits, breast of fried chicken, and a yellow yam open and steaming, with melted butter dripping from it. Mammy pinched small Jack, and he hastened to his business of slowly swishing the paper ribbons back and forth behind Ellen. Mammy stood beside the table, watching every forkful that travelled from plate to mouth, as though she intended to force the food down Ellen's throat should she see signs of flagging. Ellen ate diligently. But Scarlett could see that she was too tired to know what she was eating. Only Mammy's implacable face forced her to it. When the dish was empty, and Gerald only midway in his remarks on the thievishness of Yankees, who wanted to free darkies and yet offered no penny to pay for their freedom, Ellen rose.
"We'll be having prayers?" he questioned reluctantly.
"Yes. It is so late. Why, it is actually 10 o'clock. As the clock with coughing and tinny thumps marked the hour. Corinne should have been asleep long ago. The lamp, please, Pork. And my prayer book, Mammy." Prompted by Mammy's hoarse whisper, Jack set his fly brush in the corner and removed the dishes, while Mammy fumbled in the sideboard drawer for Ellen's worn prayer book. Pork, tiptoeing, reached the ring in the chain and drew the lamp slowly down until the tabletop was brightly bathed in light and the ceiling receded into shadows. Ellen arranged her skirts and sank to the floor on her knees, laying the open prayer book on the table before her and clasping her hands upon it. Gerald knelt beside her, and Scarlett and Sue Ellen took their accustomed places on the opposite side of the table, folding their voluminous petticoats in pads under their knees so that they would ache less from contact with the hard floor. Corinne, who was small for her age, could not kneel comfortably at the table and so knelt facing a chair, her elbows on the seat. She liked this position, for she seldom failed to go to sleep during prayers, and in this posture it escaped her mother's notice. The house servant shuffled and rustled in the hall to kneel by the doorway, Mammy groaning aloud as she sank down, Pork straight as a ramrod. Rosa and Tina, the maids, graceful in their spreading bright calicoes. Cookie gaunt and yellow beneath her snowy head rag. And Jack, stupid with sleep, as far away from Mammy's pinching fingers as possible. Their dark eyes gleamed expectantly, for praying with their white folks was one of the events of the day. The old and colourful phrases of the litany with its oriental imagery meant little to them, but it satisfied something in their hearts, and they always swayed when they chanted the responses. "Lord, have mercy on us. Christ, have mercy on us." Ellen closed her eyes and began praying, her voice rising and falling, lulling and soothing. Heads bowed in the circle of yellow light as Ellen thanked God for the health and happiness of her home, her family, and her Negroes. When she had finished her prayers for those beneath the roof of Tara, her father, mother, sisters, 3 dead babies, and all the poor souls in purgatory, she clasped her white beads between long fingers and began the rosary. Like the rushing of a soft wind, the responses from black throats and white throats rolled back. "Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death." Despite her heartache and the pain of unshed tears, a deep sense of quiet and peace fell upon Scarlett, as it always did at this hour. Some of the disappointment of the day and the dread of the morrow departed from her, leaving a feeling of hope. It was not the lifting up of her heart to God that brought this balm, for religion went no more than lip-deep with her. It was the sight of her mother's serene face upturned to the throne of God and his saints and angels, praying for blessings on those whom she loved. When Ellen intervened with heaven, Scarlett felt certain that heaven heard. Ellen finished, and Gerald, who could never find his beads at prayer time, began furtively counting his decade on his fingers. As his voice droned on, Scarlett's thought strayed, in spite of herself. She knew she should be examining her conscience. Ellen had taught her that at the end of each day it was her duty to examine her conscience thoroughly, to admit her numerous faults and pray to God for forgiveness and strength, never to repeat them.
but Scarlet was examining her heart. She dropped her head upon her folded hands so that her mother could not see her face, and her thoughts went sadly back to Ashley. How could he be planning to marry Melanie when he really loved her, Scarlet? And when he knew how much she loved him, how could he deliberately break her heart? Then, suddenly, an idea, shining anew, flashed like a comet through her brain. Why, Ashley hasn't an idea that I'm in love with him. She almost gasped aloud in the shock of its unexpectedness. Her mind stood still, as if paralyzed for a long, breathless instant, and then raced forward. How could he know? I've always acted so prissy and ladylike, and touch me not around him, he probably thinks I don't care a thing about him except as a friend. Yes, that's why he's never spoken. He thinks his love is hopeless, and that's why he's looked so... Her mind went swiftly back to those times when she had caught him looking at her in that strange manner, when the grey eyes that were such perfect curtains for his thoughts had been wide and naked, and had in them a look of torment and despair. He's been broken-hearted because he thinks I'm in love with Brent, a Stuart, a Cade, and probably he thinks that if he can't have me, he might as well please his family and marry Melanie. But if he knew I did love him... Her volatile spirit shot up from deepest depression to excited happiness. This was the answer to Ashley's reticence, to his strange conduct. He didn't know. Her vanity leaped to the aid of her desire to believe, making belief a certainty. If he knew she loved him, he would hasten to her side. She had only to... Oh, she thought rapturously, digging her fingers into her lowered brow. What a fool I've been not to think of this till now. I must think of some way to let him know. He wouldn't marry her if he knew I loved him. How could he? With a start, she realized that Gerald had finished, and her mother's eyes were on her. Hastily, she began her decade, telling off the beads automatically, but with a depth of emotion in her voice that caused Mammy to open her eyes and shoot a searching glance at her. As she finished her prayers and Sue Ellen, then Corrine, began their decades, her mind was still speeding onward with her entrancing new thought. Even now, it wasn't too late. Too often the county had been scandalized by elopements when one or the other of the participating parties was practically at the altar with a third. And Ashley's engagement had not even been announced yet. Yes, there was plenty of time. If no love lay between Ashley and Melanie, but only a promise given long ago, then why wasn't it possible for him to break that promise and marry her? Surely he would do it, if he knew that she, Scarlet, loved him. She must find some way to let him know. She would find some way. And then... Scarlet came abruptly out of her dream of delight, for she had neglected to make the responses, and her mother was looking at her reprovingly. As she resumed the ritual, she opened her eyes briefly and cast a quick glance around the room. The kneeling figures, the soft glow of the lamp, the dim shadows where the Negro swayed, even the familiar objects that had been so hateful to her sight an hour ago, in an instant, took on the color of her own emotions, and the room seemed once more a lovely place. She would never forget this moment. Or this scene. Virgin most faithful, her mother intoned. The litany of the Virgin was beginning, and obediently Scarlet responded, Pray for us. As Ellen praised in soft contralto the attributes of the Mother of God. As always, since childhood, this was for Scarlet a moment for adoration of Ellen, rather than the Virgin. Sacrilegious though it might be, Scarlet always saw, through her closed eyes, the upturned face of Ellen, and not the Blessed Virgin, as the ancient phrases were repeated. Health of the sick, seat of wisdom, refuge of sinners. mystical rose. They were beautiful words, because they were the attributes of Ellen. But tonight, because of the exaltation of her own spirit, Scarlet found in the whole ceremonial, the softly spoken words, the murmur of the responses, a surpassing beauty beyond any that she had ever experienced before. And her heart went up to God in sincere thankfulness that a pathway for her feet had been opened, out of her misery, and straight into the arms of Ashley. When the last Amen sounded, they all rose, somewhat stiffly, Mammy being hauled to her feet by the combined efforts of Tina and Rosa. Pork took a long spiller from the mantelpiece, lit it from the lamp flame, and went into the hall. Opposite the winding stairs stood a walnut sideboard, too large for use in the dining room, bearing on its wide top several lamps and a long row of candles in candlesticks. Pork lit one lamp and three candles, and, with the pompous dignity of a first chamberlain of the royal bedchamber lighting a king and queen to their rooms, he led the procession up the stairs, holding the light high above his head. Ellen, on Gerald's arm, followed him, and the girls, each taking her own candlestick, mounted after them. Scarlet entered her room, set the candle on the tall chest of drawers, and fumbled in the dark closet for the dancing dress that needed stitching. Throwing it across her arm, she crossed the hall quietly. The door of her parents' bedroom was slightly ajar, and before she could knock, Ellen's voice, low but stern, came to her ears. "Mr. O'Hara, you must dismiss Jonas Wilkerson." Gerald exploded. "And where will I be getting another overseer who wouldn't be cheating me out of me eye teeth?" "He must be dismissed immediately, tomorrow morning. Big Sam is a good foreman, and he can take over the duties until you can hire another overseer." "Aha!" came Gerald's voice. "So I understand. Then the worthy Jonas sired the—" "He must be dismissed." "So, he is the father of Emmy Slattery's baby," thought Scarlet. "Oh, well, what else can you expect from Yankee man and white trash girl?" Then, after a discreet pause which gave Gerald's splutterings time to die away, she knocked on the door and handed the dress to her mother. By the time Scarlet had undressed and blown out the candle, her plan for tomorrow had worked itself out in every detail. It was a simple plan, for with Gerald's single-mindedness of purpose, her eyes were centered on the goal, and she thought only of the most direct steps by which to reach it. First, she would be prideful, as Gerald had commanded. From the moment she arrived at 12 Oaks, she would be her gayest, most spirited self. No one would suspect that she had ever been downhearted because of Ashley and Melanie, and she would flirt with every man there. That would be cruel to Ashley, but it would make him yearn for her all the more. She wouldn't overlook a man of marriageable age, from ginger-whiskered old Frank Kennedy, who was Sue Ellen's beau, on down to shy, quiet, blushing Charles Hamilton, Melanie's brother. They would swarm around her like bees around a hive, and certainly Ashley would be drawn from Melanie to join the circle of her admirers. Then, somehow, she would maneuver to get a few minutes alone with him, away from the crowd. She hoped everything would work out that way, because it would be more difficult otherwise. But if Ashley didn't make the first move, she would simply have to do it herself. When they were finally alone, he would have fresh in his mind the picture of the other men thronging about her. He would be newly impressed with the fact that every one of them wanted her, and that look of sadness and despair would be in his eyes. Then she would make him happy again, by letting him discover that, popular though she was, she preferred him above any other man in all the world. And when she admitted it, modestly and sweetly, she would look 1,000 things more. Of course, she would do it all in a ladylike way. She wouldn't even dream of saying to him boldly that she loved him. That would never do. But the manner of telling him was a detail that troubled her not at all. She had managed such situations before, and she could do it again. Lying in the bed, with the moonlight streaming dimly over her, she pictured the whole scene in her mind. She saw the look of surprise and happiness that would come over his face when he realized that she really loved him, and she heard the words he would say, asking her to be his wife. Naturally, she would have to say then that she simply couldn't think of marrying a man when he was engaged to another girl. But he would insist, and finally, she would let herself be persuaded. Then they would decide to run off to Jonesboro that very afternoon, and why, by this time tomorrow night, she might be Mrs. Ashley Wilkes. She sat up in bed, hugging her knees, and for a long, happy moment, she was Mrs. Ashley Wilkes, Ashley's bride. Then a slight chill entered her heart. Suppose it didn't work out this way. Suppose Ashley didn't beg her to run away with him. Resolutely, she pushed the thought from her mind. "I won't think of that now," she said firmly. "If I think of it now, it will upset me. There's no reason why things won't come out the way I want them. If he loves me, and I know he does." She raised her chin, and her pale, black-fringed eyes sparkled in the moonlight. Ellen had never told her that desire and attainment were two different matters. Life had not taught her that the race was not to the swift. She lay in the silvery shadows with courage rising and made the plans that a 16-year-old makes when life has been so pleasant that defeat is an impossibility, and a pretty dress and a clear complexion are weapons to vanquish fate. Chapter 5. It was 10 o'clock in the morning. The day was warm for April, and the golden sunlight streamed brilliantly into Scarlett's room through the blue curtains of the wide windows. The cream-colored walls glowed with light, and the depths of the mahogany furniture gleamed deep red like wine, while the floor glistened as if it were glass, except where the rag rugs covered it. And they were spots of gay color. Already, summer was in the air. The first hint of Georgia summer when the high tide of spring gives way reluctantly before a fiercer heat. A balmy, soft warmth poured into the room, heavy with velvety smells, redolent of many blossoms, of newly fledged trees and of moist, freshly turned red earth. Through the window, Scarlett could see the bright riot of the twin lines of daffodils bordering the gravel driveway, and the golden masses of yellow jessamine spreading flowery sprangles modestly to the earth like crinolines. The mockingbirds and the jays, engaged in their old feud for possession of the magnolia tree beneath her window, were bickering. The jays strident, acrimonious, the mockers sweet-voiced and plaintive. Such a glowing morning usually called Scarlett to the window, to lean arms on the broad sill and drink in the scents and sounds of Terra. But today, she had no eye for sun or azure sky beyond a hasty thought. Thank God it isn't raining. On the bed lay the apple-green, watered silk ball dress with its festoons of ecru lace, neatly packed in a large cardboard box. It was ready to be carried to 12 Oaks to be donned before the dancing began, but Scarlett shrugged at the sight of it. If her plans were successful, she would not wear that dress tonight. Long before the ball began, she and Ashley would be on their way to Jonesboro to be married. The troublesome question was, what dress should she wear to the barbecue? What dress would best set off her charms and make her most irresistible to Ashley? Since 8 o'clock, she had been trying on and rejecting dresses, and now she stood dejected and irritable in lace pantalettes, linen corset cover, and three billowing lace and linen petticoats. Discarded garments lay about her on the floor, the bed, the chairs, in bright heaps of colour and straying ribbons. The rose organdy with long pink sash was becoming, but she had worn it last summer when Melanie visited Twelve Oaks, and she'd be sure to remember it. And might be catty enough to mention it. The black bombazine with its puffed sleeves and princess lace collar set off her white skin superbly, but it did make her look a trifle elderly. Scarlett peered anxiously in the mirror at her 16-year-old face, as if expecting to see wrinkles and sagging chin muscles. It would never do to appear sedate and elderly before Melanie's sweet youthfulness. The lavender-barred muslin was beautiful, with those wide insets of lace and net about the hem. But it had never suited her type. It would suit Corrine's delicate profile and wishy-washy expression perfectly, but Scarlett felt that it made her look like a schoolgirl. It would never do to appear schoolgirlish beside Melanie's poised self. The green plaid taffeta, frothing with flounces, and each flounce edged in green velvet ribbon, was most becoming, in fact her favorite dress, for it darkened her eyes to emerald. But there was unmistakably a grease spot on the front of the basque. Of course, her brooch could be pinned over the spot, but perhaps Melanie had sharp eyes. There remained vari-coloured cotton dresses, which Scarlett felt were not festive enough for the occasion, ball dresses, and the green-sprigged muslin she had worn yesterday. But it was an afternoon dress. It was not suitable for a barbecue, for it had only tiny puffed sleeves, and the neck was low enough for a dancing dress. But there was nothing else to do but wear it. After all, she was not ashamed of her neck and arms and bosom, even if it was not correct to show them in the morning. As she stood before the mirror and twisted herself about to get a side view, she thought that there was absolutely nothing about her figure to cause her shame. Her neck was short but rounded, and her arms plump and enticing. Her breasts, pushed high by her stays, were very nice breasts. She had never had to sew tiny rows of silk ruffles in the lining of her basques, as most 16-year-old girls did, to give their figures the desired curves and fullness. She was glad she had inherited Ellen's slender white hands and tiny feet, and she wished she had Ellen's height, too, but her own height pleased her very well. What a pity legs could not be shown, she thought, pulling up her petticoats and regretfully viewing them, plump and neat under pantalettes. She had such nice legs. Even the girls at the Fayetteville Academy had admitted as much. And as for her waist, there was no one in Fayetteville, Jonesboro, or three counties, for that matter, who had so small a waist. The thought of her waist brought her back to practical matters. The green muslin measured 17 inches about the waist, and Mammy had laced her for the 18-inch bombazine. Mammy would have to lace her tighter. She pushed open the door, listened, and heard Mammy's heavy tread in the downstairs hall. She shouted for her impatiently, knowing she could raise her voice with impunity, as Ellen was in the smokehouse, measuring out the day's food to Cookie. "Some folks thinks as how I can fly," grumbled Mammy, shuffling up the stairs. She entered puffing, with the expression of one who expects battle and welcomes it. In her large black hands was a tray upon which food smoked, two large yams covered with butter, a pile of buckwheat cakes dripping syrup, and a large slice of ham swimming in gravy. Catching sight of Mammy's burden, Scarlett's expression changed from one of minor irritation to obstinate belligerency. In the excitement of trying on dresses, she had forgotten Mammy's ironclad rule that, before going to any party, the O'Hara girls must be crammed so full of food at home they would be unable to eat any refreshments at the party. "It's no use. I won't eat it. You can just take it back to the kitchen." Mammy set the tray on the table and squared herself, hands on hips.
"Yas'm, you is. I ain't figuring on having happen what happened at the last barbecue when I was too sick from them chitlins I ate to fetch you no tray before you went. You is gwine eat every bite of this.
I am not. Now come here and lace me tighter, because we are late already. I heard the carriage come round to the front of the house. Mammy's tone became wheedling.
Now, Miss Scarlet, you be good and come eat just a little. Miss Corrie and Miss Llewellyn done eat all day and...
They would, said Scarlet contemptuously. They haven't any more spirit than a rabbit. But I won't. I'm through with trays. I'm not forgetting the time I ate a whole tray and went to the Calverts and they had ice cream out of ice they'd brought all the way from Savannah, and I couldn't eat but a spoonful. I'm going to have a good time today and eat as much as I please.
At this defiant heresy, Mammy's brow lowered with indignation. What a young miss could do and what she could not do were as different as black and white in Mammy's mind. There was no middle ground of deportment between. Llewellyn and Corrine were clay in her powerful hands, and hearkened respectfully to her warning. But it had always been a struggle to teach Scarlet that most of her natural impulses were unladylike. Mammy's victories over Scarlet were hard won, and represented guile unknown to the white mind.
"If you don't care about how folks talks about this family, I does," she rumbled. "I ain't gwine stand by and have everybody at de party saying how you ain't futched up right. I has told you and told you that you can always tell a lady by that she eat like a bird. And I ain't aiming to have you go to Miss Wilkes and eat like a field hand and gobble like a hog."
"Mother is a lady and she eats," countered Scarlet.
"When you is mad, you can eat too," retorted Mammy. "When Miss Ellen your age, she never ate nothing when she went out. And neither your Aunt Pauline nor Aunt Eulalie. And they all done mad. Young missus, what eats heavy, most generally don't catch husbands."
"I don't believe it. At the barbecue when you were sick and I didn't eat beforehand, Ashley Wilkes told me he liked to see a girl with a healthy appetite."
Mammy shook her head ominously.
"What gentlemen say and what they thinks is two different things. And I ain't noticed Miss Ashley axin' for to marry you."
Scarlet scowled, started to speak sharply and then caught herself. Mammy had her there, and there was no argument. Seeing the obdurate look on Scarlet's face, Mammy picked up the tray and, with the bland guile of her race, changed her tactics. As she started for the door, she sighed.
"Well, all right. I was telling Cookie while she was a-fixin' this tray, you can sure tell a lady by what she don't eat. And I say to Cookie, I ain't never seen no white lady who ate less'n Miss Melanie Hamilton did last time she was visitin' Mr. Ashley. I mean, visitin' Miss India."
Scarlet shot a look of sharp suspicion at her, but Mammy's broad face carried only a look of innocence and of regret that Scarlet was not the lady Melanie Hamilton was.
"Put down that tray and come lace me tighter," said Scarlet irritably. "And I'll try to eat a little afterwards. If I ate now, I couldn't lace tight enough."
Cloaking her triumph, Mammy set down the tray.
"What my lamb gwon wear?"
"That," answered Scarlet, pointing at the fluffy mass of green-flowered muslin. Instantly, Mammy was in arms.
"No, you ain't. It ain't fitten for mornin'. You can't show your bosom before 3 o'clock, and dat dress ain't got no neck and no sleeves. And you get freckled sure as your bone, and I ain't figuring on you getting freckled after all the buttermilk I've been putting on you all this winter, bleaching them freckles you got at Savannah setting on the beach. I sure gwine speak to your mama about you."
"If you say one word to her before I'm dressed, I won't eat a bite," said Scarlet coolly. "Mother won't have time to send me back to change once I'm dressed."
Mammy sighed resignedly, beholding herself outguessed. Between the two evils, It was better to have Scarlet wear an afternoon dress at a morning barbecue than to have her gobble like a hog.
"Hold on to something and suck in your breath,"
she commanded. Scarlet obeyed, bracing herself and catching firm hold of one of the bedposts. Mammy pulled and jerked vigorously, and as the tiny circumference of the whalebone-girdled waist grew smaller, a proud, fond look came into her eyes.
"Ain't nobody got a waist like my lamb,"
she said approvingly.
"Every time I pulls Miss Sue Ellen littler than 20 inches, she up and faint."
"Pooh," gasped Scarlet, speaking with difficulty. "I never fainted in my life."
"Well, 'twouldn't do no harm if you was to faint now and then,"
advised Mammy.
"You is so brash sometimes, Miss Scarlet. I've been aiming to tell you, it just don't look good the way you don't faint about snakes and mouses and such. I don't mean round home, but when you is out in company, and I has told you, and—"
"Oh, hurry. Don't talk so much. I'll catch a husband. See if I don't. Even if I don't scream and faint. Goodness, but my stays are tight. Put on the dress."
Mammy carefully dropped the 12 yards of green-sprigged muslin over the mountainous petticoats and hooked up the back of the tight, low-cut mask.
"You keep your shawl on your shoulders when you is in the sun, and don't you go taking off your hat when you is warm,"
she commanded.
"Elsewise you'll be coming home looking brown like old Miss Slattery. Now you come eat, honey, but don't eat too fast. No use having it come right back up again."
Scarlet obediently sat down before the tray, wondering if she would be able to get any food into her stomach and still have room to breathe. Mammy plucked a large towel from the washstand and carefully tied it around Scarlet's neck, spreading the white folds over her lap. Scarlet began on the ham because she liked ham and forced it down. "I wish to heaven I was married," she said resentfully as she attacked the yams with loathing. "I'm tired of everlastingly being unnatural and never doing anything I want to do. I'm tired of acting like I don't eat more than a bird and walking when I want to run and saying I feel faint after a waltz when I could dance for 2 days and never get tired. I'm tired of saying how wonderful you are to fool men who haven't got one half the sense I've got. And I'm tired of pretending I don't know anything so men can tell me things and feel important while they're doing it. I can't eat another bite."
"Try a hot cake,"
said Mammy inexorably.
"What is it a girl has to be so silly to catch a husband?"
"I specs it's 'cause gentlemen's don't know what they wants. They just know what they think they wants. And giving them what they think they want saves a pile of misery and being an old maid. And they think they want mousy little gals with birds' tastes and no sense at all. It don't make a gentleman feel like marrying a lady if he suspicions she got more sense than he has."
"Don't you suppose men get surprised after they're married to find that their wives do have sense?"
"Well, it's too late then. They's already married. Sides, gentlemen specs their wives to have sense."
"Some day I'm going to do and say everything I want to do and say, and if people don't like it, I don't care."
"No, you ain't,"
said Mammy grimly.
"Not well I got breath. You eat them cakes. Sop 'em into gravy, honey."
"I don't think Yankee girls have to act like such fools. When we were at Saratoga last year, I noticed plenty of them acting like they had right good sense, and in front of men, too."
Mammy snorted.
"Yankee gals. Yes'm. I guess they speaks their minds all right, but I ain't noticed many of them getting proposed to at Saratoga."
"But Yankees must get married," argued Scarlet. "They don't just grow. They must get married and have children. There's too many of them."
"Men marries them for the money," said Mammy firmly.
Scarlet sopped the wheat cake in the gravy and put it in her mouth. Perhaps there was something in what Mammy said. There must be something in it, for Ellen said the same things, in different and more delicate words. In fact, the mothers of all her girlfriends impressed on their daughters the necessity of being helpless, clinging, doe-eyed creatures. Really, it took a lot of sense to cultivate and hold such a pose. Perhaps she had been too brash. Occasionally she had argued with Ashley and frankly aired her opinions. Perhaps this and her healthy enjoyment of walking and riding had turned him from her to the frail Melanie. Perhaps if she changed her tactics. But she felt that if Ashley succumbed to premeditated feminine tricks, she could never respect him as she now did. Any man who was fool enough to fall for a simper, a feint, and an, "Oh, how wonderful you are," wasn't worth having. But they all seemed to like it. If she had used the wrong tactics with Ashley in the past, well, that was the past and done with. Today she would use different ones, the right ones. She wanted him, and she had only a few hours in which to get him. If fainting or pretending to faint would do the trick, then she would faint. If simpering, coquetry, or empty-headedness would attract him, she would gladly play the flirt and be more empty-headed than even Kathleen Calvert. And if bolder measures were necessary, she would take them. Today was the day. There was no one to tell Scarlett that her own personality, frighteningly vital though it was more attractive than any masquerade she might adopt. Had she been told, she would have been pleased but unbelieving. And the civilization of which she was a part would have been unbelieving too, for at no time, before or since, had so low a premium been placed on feminine naturalness. As the carriage bore her down the red road toward the Wilkes plantation, Scarlett had a feeling of guilty pleasure that neither her mother nor Mammy was with the party. There would be no one at the barbecue who, by delicately lifted brows or out-thrust underlip, could interfere with her plan of action. Of course, Sue Ellen would be certain to tell tales tomorrow. But if all went as Scarlett hoped, the excitement of the family over her engagement to Ashley or her elopement would more than overbalance their displeasure. Yes, she was very glad Ellen had been forced to stay at home. Gerald, primed with brandy, had given Jonas Wilkerson his dismissal that morning, and Ellen had remained at Tara to go over the accounts of the plantation before he took his departure. Scarlett had kissed her mother goodbye in the little office where she sat before the tall secretary with its paper-stuffed pigeonholes. Jonas Wilkerson, hat in hand, stood beside her, his sallow, tight-skinned face hardly concealing the fury of hate that possessed him at being so unceremoniously turned out of the best overseer's job in the county, and all because of a bit of minor philandering. He had told Gerald over and over that Emmy Slattery's baby might have been fathered by any one of a dozen men as easily as himself. An idea in which Gerald concurred, but that had not altered his case so far as Ellen was concerned. Jonas hated all Southerners. He hated their cool courtesy to him, and their contempt for his social status, so inadequately covered by their courtesy. He hated Ellen O'Hara above anyone else, for she was the epitome of all that he hated in Southerners. Mammy, as head woman of the plantation, had remained to help Ellen, and it was Dilsey who rode on the driver's seat beside Toby, the girls' dancing dresses in a long box across her lap. Gerald rode beside the carriage on his big hunter, warm with brandy, and pleased with himself for having gotten through with the unpleasant business of Wilkerson so speedily. He had shoved the responsibility onto Ellen, and her disappointment at missing the barbecue and the gathering of her friends did not enter his mind. for it was a fine spring day, and his fields were beautiful, and the birds were singing, and he felt too young and frolicsome to think of anyone else. Occasionally he burst out with Peg in a Low-Backed Car and other Irish ditties, or the more lugubrious lament for Robert Emmet, She is far from the land where her young hero sleeps. He was happy, pleasantly excited over the prospect of spending the day shouting about Yankees and the war, and proud of his three pretty daughters in their bright spreading hoop skirts beneath foolish little lace parasols. He gave no thought to his conversation of the day before with Scarlett, for it had completely slipped his mind. He only thought that she was pretty and a great credit to him, and that today her eyes were as green as the hills of Ireland. The last thought made him think better of himself, for it had a certain poetic ring to it, and so he favored the girls with a loud and slightly off-key rendition of The Wearin' of the Green. Scarlett, looking at him with the affectionate contempt that mothers feel for small swaggering sons, knew that he would be very drunk by sundown. Coming home in the dark, he would try, as usual, to jump every fence between Twelve Oaks and Tara, and she hoped, by the mercy of Providence and the good sense of his horse, would escape breaking his neck. He would disdain the bridge and swim his horse through the river and come home roaring to be put to bed on a sofa in the office by Pork, who always waited up with a lamp in the front hall on such occasions. He would ruin his new grey broadcloth suit, which would cause him to swear horribly in the morning and tell Ellen at great length how his horse fell off the bridge in the darkness, a palpable lie which would fool no one, but which would be accepted by all and make him feel very clever. Pa is a sweet, selfish, irresponsible darling, Scarlett thought, with a surge of affection for him. She felt so excited and happy this morning that she included the whole world, as well as Gerald, in her affection. She was pretty, and she knew it. She would have Ashley for her own before the day was over. The sun was warm and tender, and the glory of the Georgia spring was spread before her eyes. Along the roadside, the blackberry brambles were concealing with softest green the savage red gulches cut by the winter's rains, and the bare granite boulders pushing up through the red earth were being draped with sprangles of Cherokee roses and compassed about by wild violets of palest purple hue. Upon the wooded hills above the river, the dogwood blossoms lay glistening and white, as if snow still lingered among the greenery. The flowering crab trees were bursting their buds and rioting from delicate white to deepest pink, and beneath the trees where the sunshine dappled the pine straw, the wild honeysuckle made a varicolored carpet of scarlet and orange and rose. There was a faint wild fragrance of sweet shrub on the breeze, and the world smelled good enough to eat. "I'll remember how beautiful this day is till I die," thought Scarlett. "Perhaps it will be my wedding day." And she thought with a tingling in her heart how she and Ashley might ride swiftly through this beauty of blossom and greenery this very afternoon, or tonight, by moonlight, toward Jonesboro, and the preacher. Of course, she would have to be remarried by a priest from Atlanta, but that would be something for Ellen and Gerald to worry about. She quailed a little as she thought how white with mortification Ellen would be at hearing that her daughter had eloped with another girl's fiancé, but she knew Ellen would forgive her when she saw her happiness. And Gerald would scold and bawl, but for all his remarks of yesterday about not wanting her to marry Ashley, he would be pleased beyond words at an alliance between his family and the Wilkes. "But that'll be something to worry about after I'm married," she thought, tossing the worry from her. It was impossible to feel anything but palpitating joy in this warm sun, in the spring, with the chimney of Twelve Oaks just beginning to show on the hill across the river. "I'll live there all my life.
and I'll see 50 springs like this, and maybe more. And I'll tell my children and my grandchildren how beautiful this spring was, lovelier than any they'll ever see. She was so happy at this last thought that she joined in the last chorus of The Wearin' o' the Green, and one Gerald shouted approval.
"I don't know why you're so happy this morning," said Sue Ellen crossly,
for the thought still rankled in her mind that she would look far better in Scarlet's green silk dancing frock than its rightful owner would. And why was Scarlet always so selfish about lending her clothes and bonnets? And why did Mother always back her up, declaring green was not Sue Ellen's color?
"You know as well as I do that Ashley's engagement is going to be announced tonight. Pa said so this morning. And I know you've been sweet on him for months."
"That's all you know," said Scarlet, putting out her tongue and refusing to lose her good humor. How surprised Miss Sue would be by this time tomorrow morning.
"Susie, you know that's not so," protested Corrine, shocked. "It's Brent that Scarlet cares about."
Scarlet turned smiling green eyes upon her younger sister, wondering how anyone could be so sweet. The whole family knew that Corrine's 13-year-old heart was set upon Brent Tarleton, who never gave her a thought except as Scarlet's baby sister. When Ellen was not present, the O'Haras teased her to tears about him.
"Darling, I don't care a thing about Brent," declared Scarlet, happy enough to be generous. "And he doesn't care a thing about me. Why, he's waiting for you to grow up."
Corrine's round little face became pink as pleasure struggled with incredulity.
"Oh, Scarlet, really? Scarlet, you know Mother said Corrine was too young to think about beaux yet, and there you go putting ideas in her head." "Well, go and tattle and see if I care," replied Scarlet. "You want to hold Sissy back because you know she's going to be prettier than you in a year or so?"
"You'll be keeping civil tongues in your heads this day, or I'll be taking me crop to you," warned Gerald. "Now, whist! Is it wheels I'm hearing? That'll be the Tarletons or the Fontaines."
As they neared the intersecting road that came down the thickly wooded hill from Mimosa and Fairhill, the sound of hooves and carriage wheels became plainer, and clamorous feminine voices raised in pleasant dispute sounded from behind the screen of trees. Gerald, riding ahead, pulled up his horse and signed to Toby to stop the carriage where the two roads met.
"'Tis the Tarleton ladies," he announced to his daughters, his florid face abeam,
for excepting Ellen, there was no lady in the county he liked more than the red-haired Mrs. Tarleton.
"And 'tis herself at the reins. Ah, there's a woman with fine hands for a horse. Feather light and strong as rawhide, and pretty enough to kiss for all that. More's the pity none of you have such hands," he added, casting fond but reproving glances at his girls. "With Corrine afraid of the poor beasts, and Sue with hands like sad irons when it comes to reins, and you, puss!"
"Well, at any rate, I've never been thrown,"
cried Scarlet indignantly.
"And Mrs. Tarleton takes a toss at every hunt."
"And breaks a collarbone like a man," said Gerald. "No fainting, no fussing. Now, no more of it, for here she comes."
He stood up in his stirrups and took off his hat with a sweep as the Tarleton carriage, overflowing with girls in bright dresses and parasols and fluttering veils, came into view, with Mrs. Tarleton on the box, as Gerald had said. With her four daughters, their mammy, and their ball dresses in long cardboard boxes crowding the carriage, there was no room for the coachman. And besides, Beatrice Tarleton never willingly permitted anyone, black or white, to hold reins when her arms were out of slings. Frail, fine-boned, so white of skin that her flaming hair seemed to have drawn all the color from her face into its vital burnished mass, she was nevertheless possessed of exuberant health and untiring energy. She had borne 8 children, as red of hair and as full of life as she, and had raised them most successfully, so the county said. because she gave them all the loving neglect and the stern discipline she gave the colts she bred.
"Curb them, but don't break their spirits," was Mrs. Tarleton's motto. She loved horses, and talked horses constantly. She understood them, and handled them better than any man in the county. Colts overflowed the paddock.